ones who use our little resources to send back our communities and stuff like that. And so within this reclaiming our histories and our community being in our way of awakening and taking what is being built, the financial freedom is the future for us. I don't know if I still have more minutes.
No, you used them up a while ago. But at the same time, it was just so interesting. Like, some of the things that I gathered, because I was just typing this up, is the ways that bad press is still good press. Even if they tried to kill the community literally in the laws, the community now is thriving because you cannot be in the closet anymore. Thriving in the sense that they're visible, they're there, they're fighting, and they're very resilient. And at the same time, maybe subordinating... you were talking about how white people were writing the history because they were the ones that hold the mic. But we need... So I guess... What you're suggesting is that African queers, Black queers, queers of color take the mic in order to really rewrite history in their own hands and rewrite their futures. And lastly, the importance of self-care and remuneration, which is tied. We really need to remember that if we don't eat, we don't live, and if we don't eat well, we don't do work well. And so, yeah. So thank you very, very much for this intervention. If we can bring the floor to Adebayo. Adebayo.
It's fine.
and then we have one last set of questions afterwards.
Yeah, I think this is a very, very interesting question because I think something that is kind of a running theme even just across the conversations we've been having so far, but also just what our impurity have said so far, is one thing that we can understand is that if there's one thing that queerness will do, it's persist. Queerness is nothing if not persistent, right? And I think it's very important that we see that, like, a lot of these understandings of queerness, the colonizers tried, but they've failed awfully when it comes to, like, rubbing away that history. It's still there. A lot of our understandings of queerness, it still very much persists. And I think even outside of just the fact that, like I talk about gender-free languages, like, you know, our talks about the fact that there's still communities till today that are still practicing these understandings of queerness. And, you know, sometimes we like to talk about women-women marriages that, but they weren't about sex. Sometimes they are. These people just like to have sex, and that's fine. Like, sometimes it is about the sex, and that's cool too. And it's understanding, like, the ways that these things manifest. And I think one thing we also need to start understanding is, and I think, like, Purity talks about, is understanding, and I think Awe talks about this too, understanding ourselves from the inside out and not from the outside in. And because I think one thing you'll find is that in a lot of these Western, like non-Western global South spaces that we see as, they're homophobic, they're so bad for queer people, is that a lot of them exist actually in a blind spot, right? In a sense that we see them as patriarchal, we see them as homophobic, and these things kind of intersect to create a blind spot where queerness actually exists within these spaces, right? And this isn't just something that's like out of your ass. You have to be there to see it. Because oftentimes, again, like I say, all you need to do is land in Lagos and you'll understand exactly what I mean. The only place that I've ever been in this world that rivals the queer scene in Lagos is New York. So for me to say that, for you to understand, again, how thriving the queer scene is, and I think it's understanding that, like, these things exist. Are they safe? No. But that's, again, another thing we need to remember is that queerness does not owe you safety. Because something is not safe does not mean it's any less queer, right? Like, queerness and safety are not synonymous. Queerness and safety do not go hand in hand. They don't have to. And we always have to remove ourselves outside of the very Western, white, middle-class conceptualizations of safety. And understanding that there's queer construct that exists outside of that. And that is the resistance and the resilience. That is where the resistance and the resilience lies. And understanding that, like, we us reinventing that is how we then... Sorry, give me a second. I lost where I am in my notes.
No, take your time.
There we go. Okay, yes. So us reinventing this isn't necessarily us, like, bringing in new things or discussing, like, it's already there. All you need to do is decenter whiteness from our discussion. And I think that is very important to say explicitly and bluntly, is that, like, there is a great degree of whiteness and Western framing of our constructions of sexuality, of race, of all of these various things. And we need to decenter that from how we see, how we look at some of these spaces. Because when we start to do that, we can see, again, some of the queerness that exists in these spaces. We can start to see them outside of the colonial project. Because again, like I said, the colonial project tried, but it has absolutely failed. So it's us seeing that the future that we're speaking of, we're already there, we are living it. But again, it's very difficult for us to see that and for us to be able to actualize it and live it within ourselves, because we are stunted by the limited imagination of whiteness. Because if there's one thing whiteness, and I know I say this in a room full of white people, but y'all don't have the range. Like, it's... again, like, it's... And a lot of that exists in the language and the culture, in the way that the colonial project has been enacted. It's limited your range of imagination. And it's understanding that, like, if only we just decentered that, we will be able to see outside of that space, right? And again, a lot of these framings of queerness as un-African, we can start to see that. It's, again, like, we've all said many different ways that Africa and various African spaces that we all occupy are queer. So what does it mean when people then say queerness is un-African? So sometimes we need to understand the resistance of queerness as un-African isn't actually because they even believe that queerness is un-African. Oftentimes it's because of what they are saying is un-African is our conceptualizations of queerness and the very limited way that we see queerness, right? So it's about us being able to expand that and expand that conversation. And I think that is a big part of that decolonial work. And it's just, yeah, starting from outside of these Western white framings of that. Yeah. Is that within time though?
You literally were 2 seconds early.
2 seconds early?
Yeah.
Very demure, very mindful. You see how I'm on time?
Welcome to Switzerland. Well, speaking of decentering whiteness, I guess this was a wonderful segue into the last question, or the last set of questions. And again, the modalities are such that you can answer any or all or none if you want, but I'll ask them anyway. And so, we're going to be talking now about the weight and influence of global queer activism. And so the question is, to what degree, if at all, does global activism undermine local queer struggles? What are the influence of the West and whiteness in terms of constructing global queer activism? And can you provide concrete examples of these limitations, if there are any? And then lastly, So the last question is, what is the relevance of anti-queer solidarity through Western influences, or as it's understood in the West?
I first of all don't think that we can discuss queer liberation without discussing decolonialism or like the other side as well, because of how deeply intertwined they both are. The colonial process tried, just like we established earlier, to shape the African society into the same heteronormative norms that happened in Europe, in the UK. And at that time, I would say, from like the perspective of the white man, it made sense, because like, we need people as slaves. Why are two homosexuals married? Like, how can they give birth? So we encourage people to, we pass laws that criminalizes, two men having sex. We use shame to socially condition everyone to subscribe to heterosexuality, and then they can give birth. We encourage giving birth so that they can give birth and populate for us to have slaves. So then it's kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. Currently, I mean, not to me, to the white people, yeah. Currently, I like to call the shape that colonialism has taken as neo-colonial imperialism, in the sense that the current Western framework that we work in as activists does not allow us or give us the independence for us to do the colonial work that has to be done to get our liberation, decolonial work.
Are you talking about like the Western frameworks of in terms of LGBT activism?
Yes.
Or? Okay.
Yes. So when I say Western frameworks, I mean the LGBTQ framework that we work within. So in Ghana, to roll out projects, community projects that support queer people, you have to be very specific and targeted. I need $2,000 to support PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, for gay men living in this community. You know, you have to be that specific to even have like a chance of getting that money. And so because of that, the queerness, the queer people, you know, that happen to fall outside LGBTQ labels, I don't know how I am going to write on a proposal that I need money to support Agonwole Ajele women because they are queer, but they are not lesbians, you know. And it's not like a donor will come out and say that $5,000 for local community members who are queer but they don't identify as LGBTQ. So that gap exists, and it creates such like a huge problem because like, and I was discussing this with a friend yesterday that, so for instance, HIV intervention programs for gay men, they are for gay men. We support gay men to get access to PrEP. We support gay men to get their retrovirals. But then they are gay men. When you go to the gay community, the SASU community, there are men who sleep with men, but they do not identify as gay. They are SASU. So these men, how do we get them like the needed medications? You know, if we are serious about 80-80-80, if we are serious about that, if we are serious about ensuring that everyone achieves viral suppression, and we have a section community that simply because they do not identify or refuse to be tagged as LGBTQ, we can't serve them. You know, that's the gap. And I like to call it neoliberal imperialism.
Okay. Well, thank you. Adebayo?
Yes. this is actually something I really care about because it really does intersect with a lot of my research. And it's something that pisses me off a lot, actually, when you think when we talk about like global activism. And I think particularly because when you see how queer activism then manifests in spaces like Lagos, and you can probably imagine, I don't like a lot of the activists, they don't like me, and they don't like each other, right? And a lot of that is because of the way queer activism then manifests in this space, is because, you know, you have this very global NGOization of activism where you are really depending on one or two people to do the work that millions should be doing. Like, this is not the work of just one, two, three people in the room or one, two, three organizations. This is something that we should at all absolutely be involved in, right? But again, when you have this reduction of various people who are the ones that are able to get all the opportunities, they're the ones getting all the funding, they're the ones getting all the public awareness, all the social capital and financial capital, and the competition that all of that like breeds. But that's beef that we're all currently fighting at the moment, so I won't bring that beef here. However, I think for me, a lot of that conversation also sits with how we look and perform activism in a very flat and reductive identity framework. And I think if there's one thing that we can take away from the conversation today is this issue of identity versus act, right? And I think it's important that we start to see the queer struggle in spaces outside of, again, Western spaces, beyond just that queer identity and them having their rights or they don't have rights or whatever, but also start to look at how it affects all people who experience queerness in one way or another, right? Whether the rights are there or not. And I think a very good way for us to see this is how a lot of the discourse started to shape when we think about the Palestinian issue, right? Because a lot of people don't understand the Palestinian struggle as a queer struggle. And oftentimes it's because they're like, oh, but if you go to Israel, they have pride over there. And again, it's this idea of, oh yeah, but if I go to Palestine, I'm going to be murdered or I'm going to be killed because I'm a queer person. And that means you won't stand in solidarity with, but understanding that they are queer people in Palestine, whether you like it or not, who also deserve our solidarity. So whether we are choosing to define queerness in one, in whatever way we're choosing to look at that, like, it's important that we see that it's not just about the spaces that grant access to the queer identity or queer rights that deserve our solidarity and deserve our work and efforts. It also goes to wherever queer people are, period, right? And so, thank you. And so I think a lot of that conversation allows us to understand how our movements have to be transnational and intersectional, right? So it's about going outside of just ourselves and our geographical locations, but also ourselves and our identities, and understanding how a lot of these things are compounded in various ways, right? And I think in the name of that solidarity, we need to start shifting our understanding of solidarity outside of just pure allyship. Because I think one thing a lot of people practice is allyship because you think you are removed from the problem. And one thing you need to understand is the yardstick of oppression is forever changing. It will come for you one day. We say something in Nigeria, we say that everybody got chopped breakfast, which is like, it's coming for you. It's going to be your turn one day, right? So if you think you're sitting in your position of privilege and you think, oh, yeah, you're protected, so you don't have to care about the struggles that other people are going through, wait. All you have to do is just wait. And right? And so, and I think we need to start... we need to start seeing that conversation, right, and start framing it as not something that is like this implicit idea that, oh yeah, we're privileged and we need to start supporting and showing solidarity with people outside of Europe. Or like I've told you, we are more queer than you all are. And I think this is the problem, is that like the Western space, you like to present yourselves as a utopia because you have these alleged queer rights, which you don't have, I'm not gonna lie to you. Because again, when you think about it intersectionally and transnationally, there are many queer people in these spaces that are not afforded their humanity, right? When you think about how queerness intersects with immigration laws, when you think about how it intersects with race, how it intersects with class, there are many queer people here who are not afforded privilege. So this is not a queer utopia. And this is not even like, yeah, it's about understanding that in the sense that you are not removed from the problem. So when you're standing in solidarity with people outside of this space, when you're standing in solidarity with Palestine, when you're standing in solidarity with Nigerians, with Ugandans, with Ghanaians, you are not doing us a favor. You're doing it for yourself because ultimately you are in this too, right? And I think it's that conceptualization that can hopefully allow us to start actually doing this work, because you're seeing that it's not just... because it's not touching you today does not mean tomorrow it's not going to come for you. And we've seen this evidence with so many things. In Uganda, for example, they have an NGO Act that was passed in 2016, right? Up until the NGO Act was passed, it was just LGBT people that they were punishing, right? And because of the struggles that they had in regards to passing the LGBT law and actually criminalizing LGBT people, and they saw they couldn't do that, what they did was instead pass the NGO Act. So what that meant was NGO people have to go through a lot of scrutiny in regards to mobilizing, so they can't mobilize for LGBT people. But what does that mean? It means that even NGOs that are mobilizing for women's rights, NGOs that are mobilizing for poor people, that are mobilizing for healthcare, they are also now affected by this issue. Now, what would have happened if they had all stood in solidarity and worked with LGBT people when we were fighting for those rights, right? And it's about understanding how, like, the system is forever finding a new victim. So one day it's going to come for everybody. So, I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. And last but not least, Purity.
Yes. The other speakers have almost said everything. And when Adebayo, everything, what should I say? When Adebayo was talking about, you know, solidarity, I remembered the new era of anti-gender movement. Really, and it's not as bad in Africa as it is in Europe, as it is in the US, you know. The Trump 2025 agenda is erasing the trans movement, you know. Even here in Europe, we are fighting for the basics. Like, nobody is actually safe in our community. It's no longer just about one community. Literally, the gender movements are begun in the Western world and then transferred back to where we come from. Because our people don't understand these terms and these concepts and stuff like that. They are just sitting on TV waiting for what Trump will say, and then they'll implement it. Well, it is also like here in Europe, we see that the far-right politicians doing exactly copy and paste from the US. And so this kind of solidarity should just remind us as the queer movement with our white people not to be comfortable at all. You cannot even pretend to be comfortable anymore, because we see it. We are still enslaved as a community globally. But then when you talk about the diversity of allyship and activism and how it influences our movements back home, it's like, you know, I always tell my white friends, I can't see them in the audience, probably they are there. Thank God I can't see them, so I can gossip about them. Yeah, I live for the gossip. White people took over our trans movement, and I was like, what? They erased Stonewall from us. Like, when they are talking about pride, they remember Masha, and that's it. They don't look at these struggles and take them with us, who are actually the ones that brings out what a proper world should look like for the queer community, you know? And the more we are begging to be in these spaces, the more we are actually, you are actually taking away from your own selves to know what was the use of, for example, Stonewall. Who was that brave to render their lives like Masha to die, and then birth a beautiful thing like pride? And then now, in your concepts, it is capitalism. Capitalism took over, and we became vulnerable again. And we are the ones just on your screens, you know, shouting and doing a lot of noise and stuff like that. So that kind of activism, also when it comes to how this affects our communities, is like, for example, when you talk about Uganda right now, or maybe even in your other countries, it's like when our politicians are talking about queer rights, they talk about it in terms of trans rights. Men who want to become women, women who want to become men. In that kind of concept. Why? Because the Western world has put us in cages of, gender identities, and they have made it like so much formal for themselves. But then it has actually penalized our communities. When you go, for example, to Uganda, majority of the vocal trans activists had to run away, including myself, you know, because we are the target at the forefront. Why? It is a depiction of what they see from the West, and then they carry it along. So if we have to start looking out for those people who are the targets, and think about how do we empower them the more, actually support their own communities, than just being the victims of a system that is actually not their own concept, but a concept from the West. So that is one. But then also, I always remember that the colonial mindset is still instilled in most of the white queer spaces. Like, there is a version of who we are that you look at. And it is not probably maybe in that space. It is in the spaces of power. In every sense, everybody has to first look out for their own, like, the trust issues, you know, when it comes to opportunities, when it comes to power, that one we never sit on the same table. You know, white people and power, you can never sit on the same table. And you can never see it, you know? It is just smiles on the street and all purity, all Adebayo, we are friends and stuff like that, but we can never see it. When it comes to that power, in those circles, in those spaces, she was talking about funding. You know, funding in most cases, we only get peanut and, you know, what you don't, you know, they just even hide ideas from us, the ideas we have given them of how much funding they should get for their communities. But then we only get the peanut that is left. So not until when we sit down and realize that this is a global movement and a global fight, then we shall, what might erupt in the future might be the fact that the anti-gender movements, for example, could take over the world because Trump is almost taking over USA and people are believing it. How do we shift that mindset? It is just being a team and bringing together ideas that are so much very practical. For example, like the ideas that were birthed at Stonewall, those practical ideas. I hope this time I was on time.
You were, yes.
I was looking at the 5 minutes.
So I have so many questions, but I think that I will humble myself and open the floor to audience members who might actually have questions that they want to answer this wonderful panel. Maybe I can. We have one person there. Should we take? How do you guys feel? If we take multiple questions, or would you want like one question at a time? Sorry, one at a time. Okay, sure.
I actually had two questions, so I don't know if that's okay.
I think one at a time and one person at a time.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question about like the NGO, like LGBT NGOs in Nigeria, Ghana, you know, Uganda, or any other countries in Africa. Like because I've worked with one in Nigeria and Adebayo, I know what you were saying about the beef. I totally get it. So I'm just like thinking about this question of like, what are more sustainable ways of supporting the queer community in these countries in Africa, like that are not so reliant on, I guess, that Western framework of like LGBT. It's kind of a really broad question, but I'm just really curious about that.
What was your second question? Yeah. Sure.
Okay. I mean, it was a really small one, but I just wanted to ask Adebayo if you've actually been to Nigeria and if you ever experienced any like homophobic violence there or anything that kind of made you feel like you don't want to return back there in any way.
Okay. So to answer your question on allyship, I also want to ask if there's anyone here who considers themselves a voice of the voiceless. You know, it's a very common thing. Mm. Voice of the voiceless. What do we? Yeah, white saviors. So, I one time received an email from this white woman who was hoping to collaborate with me. And the email signature, you know, was in quotes, like, voice of the voiceless in blue.
Oh, no. Unironically.
Yeah, to discuss allyship, I like to go on a journey where we try to differentiate saviorism from allyship, because they are two very different things. I have had a lot of times when people, like, the interactions between people, cis people and queer people, people with material, money, and queer people has not been like on a balanced level. It is not on a balanced level. And so because of that, there is a general, I don't want to say attempt, but propensity to present ourselves as saviors if we are trying to support queerness. That's number one. In terms of allyship, there are so many ways of allying with queer people that exist outside NGOs. One of them is supporting my work. Thank you. And the other is generally donating to very local organizers directly. Like, that is what I generally do if I want to donate to anyone. I would rather